Welcome back to ThoughtCast, also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Atiyah. First-time author Carol Bundy spoke at the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge recently on the subject of her new biography, an elite young Union cavalryman who fought and died in the Civil War. It's called The Nature of Sacrifice, a biography of Charles Russell Lowell, Jr. Lowell's life, begun in privilege, is a tale of quiet heroism. His death in pursuit of an ideal took place on the battlefield of Cedar Creek in the Shenandoah Valley. Bundy, who has previously written for film, tells his story.
Thank you all for coming. Usually I'm the one in the audience, so this will be a nice change. I'm not going to read from The Nature of Sacrifice. I'd just like to say a few words about Lowell. Sitting on the banks of Lake Geneva in 1856, his cousin Nina confided to her diary that she found Charlie Lowell to be an improving sort of person. And I can say that after spending a decade with him, I think that's true. My attraction to him was for many reasons, some a little frivolous. He knew all the right people. Emerson, Hawthorne, Melville. He knew the great railroad magnates of the period and great cavalry generals of the period. And inevitably, he ended up doing all the interesting things of the 19th century. So for anybody who loves that period of American history, he was a natural person to be drawn to. And then I thought his story was romantic and poignant in the way that usually is the case with Confederate stories and very rarely with the Union, and that made it somewhat irresistible. And finally, perhaps my worst reason for writing the book was that I thought a short life meant a short book. But I did have one serious reason, and that was that I had recently been in South Africa, and I recognized in Lowell the same intense commitment to country that I had seen among young South Africans, white, black, Indian. It was an awareness that they lived in important times and that the fate of their nation was in the balance, and that their actions could make a difference. As I pursued Charlie Lowell, this ended up becoming more and more the reason for continuing the pursuit. He was a disciple of Ralph Waldo Emerson. And at his Harvard commencement in 1854, he argued that the value of young men was not their physical labor, but their fresh ideals. Out of their dreams would come new realities. 10 years later, he died, as so many young men have died, serving his country, commanding a Union cavalry brigade alongside Custer, and displaying a pragmatism and courage that astonished even the most hard-bitten professional officers. In the crucible of civil war, Lowell's idealism was tested by bitter truths and starkest realities. Tempered and thus refined, he became the transcendental cavalier. He believed the world advanced by impossibilities achieved. And although he certainly meant the innovations that fueled the Industrial Revolution in America, events which his family had played a key part, he also, and more significantly, meant the eradication of slavery, for he was the third generation in his family to oppose the institution. And yet, his paternal grandfather, the Reverend Charles Lowell, was one of very few Boston ministers who spoke out against slavery, and his uncle James Russell Lowell's abolition was more literary. He was the editor of the Anti-Slavery Standard, and his poem, The Bigelow Papers, gave voice to New England's opposition not only to the expansionist war of the South into Mexico, but to the then rancorous national fight over the spoils of that war, which resulted in the Compromise of 1850 and its notorious fugitive slave law. So in 1854, when Charlie Lowell watched the fugitive slave Anthony Burns be marched down to board ship and return to bondage, he was convinced that his parents' generation and all preceding generations had failed. To them, the slave remained property. Only a new generation, his own, for whom the slave's humanity was foremost, would have the will to abolish slavery. Although tempted to dedicate himself to the struggle, he was committed to recouping the family fortune. His father had gone bankrupt trying to be the first man to smelt iron in America. And Lowell made a brilliant start in the iron business. Then tuberculosis struck, and he spent 2 years convalescing in Europe. He toured the galleries of Rome with Nathaniel Hawthorne. He became an accomplished horseman and learned to use the saber in North Africa. And once well enough, he resumed his career in the boom town of Iowa, Burlington, Iowa, overlooking the Mississippi River as treasurer of the fledgling Chicago, Burlington, and Quincy Railroad. 2 years in the Midwest building a railroad and observing the birth of the Republican Party did much to sober his politics. He came to understand the economic realities of industrialization and that the slave economy had a limited lifespan. By 1860, when he returned east to become manager of a foundry in western Maryland, his plan was to spend 10 years in business, making enough money to then devote himself to public service. However, Lincoln's election, which he wholeheartedly supported, became the catalyst for secession. And although Lowell was in New Orleans when Louisiana seceded, he doubted anything so dramatic as war would occur. He did not respond when Lincoln's call for troops after the firing of Fort Sumner came. It was only by coincidence that he was in Baltimore on April 19, 1861, when an angry mob attacked Massachusetts volunteers as they changed trains for Washington. This attack and the spilling of Massachusetts blood motivated Lowell to go directly to Washington and apply for a commission in the regular army. Awaiting his commission, Lowell worked as the agent for Massachusetts troops, and he saw it firsthand how confused and chaotic was the mobilization effort. Commissioned a captain in the 6th Cavalry, he became friends with many of the young West Point officers who would later be the making of the Union Cavalry. During the Peninsula Campaign in the spring of 1862, he became the aide-de-camp to General McClellan and served at Antietam, where he earned the coveted honor of delivering the captured battle flags to the Secretary of War. And while these early experiences would later prove invaluable, he was not immediately satisfied. The cavalry was not properly used. McClellan was a master planner, but hesitant in action. As a regular officer appointed to a staff position, Lowell spent long months recruiting, training, organizing, supplying, while his friends in the volunteer army were fighting and dying. In April 1861, Lowell predicted that volunteers would be food for cannons, but he had no idea of the emotional impact of that truth until October 1861, when his cousin, William Lowell Putnam, was killed at Ball's Bluff. In July, his brother James Jackson Lowell died in enemy hands of wounds received at Glendale. On August 9th, at Cedar Mountain, a good portion of his childhood companions were killed, among them Richard Goodwin, who was so ill that only with the help of his servant was he able to march to battle. And hardly had he reached the front when both he and his servant were killed, neither having actually fought. Richard Carey, a member of his childhood gang, and James Savage, a Christian abolitionist, a man of searing rectitude, universally admired, adored by his men. Savage had been the leader of Lowell's childhood comrades. the hero of the snowball fight between the Beacon Street cowards and the newcomers on the Boston Common, recounted in The Education of Henry Adams by that junior member of the gang. Most traumatic was the death of Stephen Perkins. Shot 3 times in the head, Perkins had had a kind of Grecian beauty. Lowell and Perkins had crossed the Alps together. Exhilarated by traversing glaciers and debating the meaning of life, it was Perkins who had posed the question, "I wonder whether we shall go on constantly expecting life to unfold itself and the great possibilities to appear in us and around us until we are surprised that death has come for us when we hardly seem to ourselves to have lived." It is the question that Henry James explored in the short story, The Beast in the Jungle. At Second Bull Run, his cousin Warren Dutton died, and at Antietam, among many others, William Sedgwick and Wilder Dwight. Those at home saw these young men as heroes and martyrs. But Lowell was more conscious of the errors and the sloppiness that contributed to their deaths. A redoubled sense of obligation went hand in hand with the resolve to help make the Army an effective and disciplined fighting force. His opportunity came in late 1862 when he went back to Boston to raise, train, and command the 2nd Massachusetts Cavalry, and he began his intimate association with the 3 principals behind the Massachusetts war effort: Governor John Andrew, a radical Christian evangelical abolitionist from Maine, the China trade merchant John Murray Forbes, a man of astounding enterprise, and the textile magnate Amos Adams Lawrence. Lowell became involved in the creation of the 54th Massachusetts Infantry, which his friend Robert Gould Shaw commanded. Over the winter of 1863-63, the 2 regiments, one white, one black, trained together. Lowell became engaged to Shaw's sister, Josephine Shaw, known as Effie, and they were a charmed couple at the forefront of the war's turn from a fight to restore the Union to the larger and radical objective of emancipation. By the summer of 1863, Lowell had returned to the front and his war had turned nasty. The victory at Gettysburg was tempered by more deaths, most intimately his classmate Paul Revere, grandson of the Revolutionary rider, and his cousins Samuel Starrow and Sumner Payne. Then came news of the senseless slaughter of the 54th Regiment at Fort Wagner outside Charleston, South Carolina, in mid-July. Lowell's cousin, Cabot Russell, was missing, last seen on the ramparts with Shaw. But it was Robert Gould Shaw's heroic death that had the greatest impact on Lowell. The accumulated guilt of surviving when so many of his nearest friends and relations had not crystallized as Lowell struggled to console his wife over the loss of her brother. He developed an almost mystical sense of personal mission. From a base in Vienna, Virginia, he began a 10-month struggle to counter guerrilla operations in Virginia, specifically to foil and defeat John Singleton Mosby and his partisan Rangers, the swashbuckling heroes of Confederate lore. But from Lowell's perspective, this was inglorious warfare. His men called it police work. Mosby fought rough. Like most guerrillas, his strength lay in breaking every rule and convention regarding war. Ambushes were constant, and in 2 instances, devastating for the regiment. Favorite officers were killed, large numbers of men taken prisoner, and for those who survived, the experience of humiliating defeat in an unfair fight. Lowell tried to fight fair, constrained not only by his own sense of decency, but also by General Order 100, or Lieber's Code. This seminal document was the first attempt to codify the rules of war as they concern civilians. It is the base document from which the Geneva Conventions are drawn, the cornerstone of our understanding of humanitarian law. And even thus constrained, Lowell was more successful fighting Mosby than any other Union commander. Twice he wounded him, but could not kill the elusive guerrilla leader. Time and again, Mosby and his men disappeared into the care of Virginia farmers, and these same farmers harassed and reported on every move Lowell made. Under such pressure, the regiment suffered more than its share of low morale. That winter, one of the coldest on record, desertion was rife. In February, a scouting party was ambushed by Mosby's men, and during the skirmish, an outraged sergeant recognized the man shooting at him. He was a deserter from his own company, and the sergeant promptly captured him. Brought into camp, the unfortunate youth was, at Lowell's orders, tried at once by a drumhead court-martial and executed at dawn the following day before the assembled regiment. A summary execution only 16 miles from Washington was exceptional. And in this case, even in this case where treason was the additional and graver offense than desertion. Lowell submitted to his superiors a complete record of the court-martial hearing and stated frankly that he had ordered and carried out the execution. He expected to be court-martialed, but his report was buried by his superiors. Even more extraordinary, the condemned man used his final words to support Lowell's order for his own execution. In August 1864, Lowell and his regiment gladly left behind Mosby and guerrilla warfare for the Cavalry Corps in the newly organized Middle Military Department, destined for the Second Shenandoah Valley Campaign under General Philip Sheridan. The objective was to defeat the forces of General Jubal Early and drive the Confederates out of their stronghold, sanctuary, and source of supply, the Shenandoah Valley. If he succeeded, the noose around Lee's main army would tighten and the end be near. If he failed, the Confederates might hold out much longer, and in the face of the gathering voice for peace at any price in the North, might gain their independence. Lowell and his men soon learned that much of the ugliness they had assumed was unique to guerrilla action was now pervasive. Grant substantially altered military objectives when he ordered Sheridan's cavalry to pursue a scorched earth policy, destroying civilian resources. At the height of the harvest, in some of the nation's most fertile and beautiful countryside, the orders to burn were repugnant. Army policy towards civilians was further complicated when Mosby carried his guerrilla activity into the Shenandoah Valley. Despite Lowell's scrupulous attitude, he and his men were at the heart of the Front Royal affair. This was one of the best documented atrocities of the Civil War, in which Union officers and men tortured and killed at least 6 prisoners. Sheridan, a trained infantry commander, was responsible for a strategic breakthrough in the use of cavalry. No longer simply tacked on to various infantry forces as scouts, it was used as a massed assault weapon of deadly and omnipotent force, and the casualty rates soared. Lowell's talents were recognized, and he was promoted to command the reserve brigade of the regular cavalry, General Buford's old command. In this capacity, he was in the thickest of the fighting at Winchester and then at Tom's Brook, popularly known as the Woodstock Races, because of a 30-mile chase of fleeing Confederates. Victory had become destruction. And to experience destruction on this scale, even as the destroyer, was transformative. Through this period, Lowell had the close support of his wife, Effie, who after their marriage in 1863 came to live in his headquarters, caring for the wounded and establishing a small school for ex-slaves who collected at the encampment. In late July of 1864, 4 months pregnant, she returned home. And their almost daily correspondence until his death is a remarkable record. Lowell felt free to discuss politics, military policy, and the moral ambiguity of his difficult decisions. Many of the letters discuss their life after the war and the anticipated birth of their child and Lowell's desire to survive. He also wrote to his friends who were now out of the war. By this stage, he was the only one from his family, from his childhood gang, from his Harvard class, still fighting. And Lowell accepted that his fate was to fight for them all. To his surviving friends, men like Greeley Curtis and Charles Francis Adams, both friends from the Boston Latin School, or Frank Barlow, who had also been a protege of Emerson and who had proved an even better general than Lowell, but had broken down at news of his wife's death from yellow fever. She had, as a nurse, twice saved his life. Oliver Wendell Holmes, his much younger and admiring cousin, who later became the legendary Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And his closest cousin and best friend, Henry Lee Higginson, who subsequently founded the Boston Symphony Orchestra and for the rest of his life made charitable gifts in Lowell's name. To these friends, Lowell now declared his ideal to be the useful citizen. He recognized that the enormous task of rebuilding the nation required what he called mighty, unpretending heroes. And his goal for life after the war was to look a Southern stranger in the eye. He urged his friends to set that as their goal as well. By mid-October, Early's men no longer had forage in the Shenandoah Valley. They would have to fight soon or cede the valley to the Union. And yet Lowell was convinced that the fate of the nation would be decided not on the battlefield, but at the ballot box. McClellan had promised to sue for peace, a peace that would preserve slavery and, from Lowell's point of view, render pointless all that his kinsmen had died for. Lincoln's reelection was paramount. On October 19, as his troops set out on a pre-dawn scout, they spotted Early's men creeping across a ford in the morning fog and then heard firing to their left. Without orders, Lowell at first waited helplessly. Then, as he realized that Early's surprise attack was succeeding and that the lack of orders was not intentional, he led two brigades 3 miles across the battlefield as if on military parade. He drew Confederate fire onto his own men. This gave the infantry, caught unprepared in their tents or in camps and fleeing to the rear in varying degrees of panic and disorder, a chance to calm and reorganize. Reaching the main road, he finally received orders to prevent the Confederates, lodged in the village of Middletown, from continuing their pursuit of the Union infantry. Some of his men took the extreme advance position behind stone walls and trees, provided cover for a series of charges on the well-fortified town. Meanwhile, the rest of the cavalry massed on the road outside the town, and Early's men grew timid. Arrogantly parading just out of range, the Union cavalry presented themselves as preparing for a charge. Behind them was chaos as Union infantry officers attempted to rally their men and reform their units. While returning from one of these charges on Middletown, Lowell was first wounded. Despite a collapsed lung and internal hemorrhaging, he refused to leave the field and continued to conduct his men's delaying tactics while Sheridan rallied his infantry. Not till 4 in the afternoon was the signal given for the counterassault. In recognition of his contribution and knowing that in all likelihood he was already dying, General Merritt asked Lowell to lead the charge. Strapped into his saddle, he rode to the front of the 3,000 horsemen. Immediately he gave the signal, the bugles sounded, and he took off. The cavalry followed, enveloped in deafening thunder from the horses' hooves pounding the earth. Almost instantly he was shot through the spine by the sharpshooters on the rooftops of the village. He fell from his horse paralyzed and was carried on a litter behind his men as they retook the village. Through the night, he dictated final letters, gave orders, and with the dawn of the next day, died. The Battle of Cedar Creek became a tremendous Union victory, breaking the Confederate cavalry, destroying the strategic value of the Shenandoah Valley, and providing Lincoln with a victory just 2 weeks before his reelection. In many ways, Lowell's life is a very simple story of a young man who challenged himself to live a heroic life and then went out and lived it. He could look back on all his youthful theories of reform, of self-culture, of subtle Emersonian concepts, and recognize that war had boiled it all down and taught him that the great secret in doing is in seeing what needs to be done. But heroic action was only part of it. The moral and ethical challenges he faced in war remind us that nothing is very simple. Initially, he had been as anxious as any to be tested in battle. But that had changed with experience. He had passed the test, but the lesson learned was not what he expected. Military leadership was not, Lowell learned, the ultimate challenge so many young men had imagined it would be. He wrote his wife, "I wish I could feel as sure of doing my duty elsewhere as I am of doing it on the field of battle." With chagrin, he confessed that he found it easier to see what needs to be done in the crisis of the battlefield than in the relative calm of civilian life. And in 1864, as he made his way across a battlefield, sending men to kill and be killed, to burn wheat fields and to execute guerrillas, what sustained him was his new ideal of heroics, what he called a patriot's duty, performing the small, lackluster tasks that need to be done in peacetime for peaceful living. Thank you.
You've been listening to author Carol Bundy talk about her new book, The Nature of Sacrifice, a biography of Charles Russell Lowell, Jr. This is ThoughtCast, also podcast on the web at www.thoughtcast.org. I'm Jenny Attia. Thanks for joining us.